The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
All right. Welcome to a Tuesday, everybody. Yeah, it is Tuesday. And sadly, it's another Tuesday laughless. Well, laughy-less. Because, you know, for I don't even know how many years, but gotta laugh, it's been my regular guest every Tuesday for many years. Until the last few weeks. And what happened is she developed a really bad case of tendonitis. And having never experienced it, I can only imagine, and from what she tells me, it really is uncomfortable. And her hands just, oh, shoot. And there's my daughter calling, and she knows that I'm on the air. So, sorry, Allison. So anyway, Laffy finally went to a doctor. She's doing physical therapy. She said she's now able to bend the fingers in one hand. Apparently, it's been really bad. So she will be back eventually once she's feeling better. So we are giving her patience and sending out healing thoughts and all that stuff. So she still, you know, reads everything on Twitter. She just can't type. So she's kind of miserable. So send good, happy, healing thoughts. So today we are going to focus on a really important subject, and that is our planet and how to save it. There's a new book I was just sent. It's called Climate Courage: How Tackling Climate Change Can Build Community, Transform the Economy, and Bridge the Political Divide in America. And I was kind of intrigued by that title, because talking about climate change, bridging the political divide in America, when we have an opposition party, I'll put it that way, who really still talks about climate change as if it's a hoax. They know it's not a hoax. They just don't like anything that's going to impact their bottom line. So it just doesn't make sense that they're not embracing at least parts of a Green New Deal, which would put the nation back to work with green friendly, earth friendly jobs. But anyway, so we'll speak with Andreas Karelas in the last half hour of the show, who puts his money where his mouth is. He runs a company that is a nonprofit organization that what they say is they empower people around the country to help nonprofits in their communities go solar while raising awareness about the benefits of clean energy. And so I've got a million questions for him. And the thing that I really like about what I've read about him is he approaches it all with a very positive attitude, like, yes, we can do this, as opposed to what some of us believe, which is, oh my God, we're fucked and we're all going to die, and the planet is going to warm over and we're going to flood and we're going to have these 100-year storms every year, every 6 months, and like that. So hopefully he'll disavow me of those notions and tell us all what we can do to help save our world. Because we've only got one. So that's coming up. There's always, when I'm sitting down to do the show, I go through a number of processes throughout the day. I wake up early in the morning and I write and produce the What's News segment. It runs at the top of the hour, many hours throughout the day on the Progressive Voices Network, where the show runs live weekdays at 5 Eastern. But there's usually more than 6 minutes worth of news. So I do a longer What's News version encompassing everything that's going on. And then I cut it down to 6 minutes for Progressive Voices. I podcast out the long version. Progressive Voices also puts the long version on their on-demand page at progressivevoices.com. So you can get it there. You can get it from NicoleSandler.com. If you subscribe to the podcast, which is not behind a paywall, it's always free, you get What's News as sort of a bonus. So, I start with that kind of outline of the news of the day and then see where it takes me to figure out, where I'm going to start the show. And to be quite honest with you, there are some days when I come in here, it's 5 o'clock, and I really don't know what I'm going to start off talking about. I just sort of go. It's wherever I feel compelled, whatever direction I feel compelled to go on, I do. And today, though, something happened just a couple of hours ago. And, I find little nuggets, little breadcrumbs, as it were, on Twitter. So, for instance, today, all of a sudden on Twitter, I started seeing all these tweets about Mitch McConnell. Mitch McConnell warning Democrats of what the Republicans might do if the Democrats should dare to, to knock off the filibuster, which is what they should do, because it's the only way that we're going to have any meaningful progress going forward. I mean, I know that the Biden administration has big priorities: immigration reform, infrastructure. And the infrastructure also encompasses the Green New Deal, because it would be funding works projects to put people back to work, people who can no longer work in the coal mines because hopefully we've shut them all down, in the oil wells and all that, put them to work in other, infrastructure building fields. So, but that's not what Mitch McConnell said. And apparently he got pissed off about a couple of things. One was yesterday on the Senate floor, Dick Durbin, who's the number two guy for the Democrats in the Senate, basically came out in support of filibuster reform. Then Stacey Abrams was on State of the Union, CNN's Sunday show with Jake Tapper. And listen to what Stacey Abrams said. It's Stacey Abrams, just so you know. She's brilliant. I credit her for the Democrats having control of the Senate, for the work she did in Georgia. I think she is fantastic. She's wonderful. But she's not the most progressive out there. So those who want to label her as, oh, she's a commie socialist, she isn't. She's fairly centrist. You know, maybe leans a little bit progressive, but she is not in the same progressive universe as Bernie Sanders and AOC and even Katie Porter. She's just not that. She's a little bit more in the middle, which should make some of these Republicans and conservatives very happy. So Stacey Abrams goes on State of the Union with Jake Tapper on Sunday, and they have this little exchange.
The House just passed a sweeping voting reform bill. It's about to run into the Senate filibuster. House Majority Whip Jim Clyburn said it would be catastrophic if the filibuster was allowed to be used to block these efforts to ensure voting rights. What's your message to Democratic senators such as Kyrsten Sinema or Senator Joe Manchin, or even to President Biden, who all support voting rights but have made clear that they're not in favor of eliminating the filibuster, which will all but guarantee this bill dies?
I don't believe that it's necessary to wholly eliminate the filibuster to accomplish the purposes of passing these bills. The Elections Clause in the Constitution guarantees that the Congress alone has the power to regulate the time, manner, and place of elections. That is a power that is sacrosanct. We are watching across this country as individual legislators try to use the big lie to restrict access to the right to vote. And just as we have seen an exemption carved into the filibuster rules for judicial appointments, for cabinet appointments, and for budget reconciliation, the protection of our democracy, especially in the wake of the insurrection on January 6th, and its continued ripples throughout our state legislatures, it demands that the entire U.S. Senate acknowledge that protection of democracy is so fundamental that it should be exempt from the filibuster rules. And we encourage everyone to go to fairfight.com to learn more.
Okay, so there's Stacey Abrams saying, so they don't need to totally kill the filibuster. Maybe we just need to carve out an exception that when we're talking about voting rights, that the filibuster doesn't apply. Because think about it. I mean, voting rights are most basic of democratic, small d, democratic rights. Mitch McConnell, well, is having nothing of it. So Mitch McConnell goes on the House floor, the Senate floor today. And let me share with you some, I'm going to pull it up this way so I can have the video up and pause him when I need to jump in to say something, because I've got a few choice words for Mr. McTurtle McConnell. So this is midway through. He spoke for about 11 or 12 minutes. This is almost at the 6 minute mark where we're going to join Moscow Mitch in progress.
So let me say this very clearly.
Yeah.
For all 99 of my colleagues, nobody serving in this chamber can even begin to imagine what a completely scorched earth Senate would look like.
Oh, really? No.
None of us have served 1 minute in a Senate that was completely drained of comedy.
And comedy, C-O-M-I-T-Y, as opposed to C-O-M-E-D-Y. Believe me, there's nothing funny about this Senate. But comedy, as he mispronounced, is what's the best definition of comedy? Is getting along. It's sort of brotherhoodness. I'm drawing a blank. Harmony. It's getting along. It's working with one another in harmony is sort of what comedy means. Bullshit, Mitch. You know, you presided over Senate for the last 4 years until the Democrats retook control following Georgia's special election in January. There was zero comity there. You did nothing to try to bring Democrats into the legislation that you tried to push through. You pushed through whatever you could. This man speaks out of both sides of his mouth. And it sounds like puke.
And consent. This is an institution that requires unanimous consent to turn the lights on before noon.
Yeah.
To proceed with a garden variety floor speech.
Okay.
To dispense with the reading of lengthy legislative text. To schedule committee business.
Yeah, it does.
To move even non-controversial nominees at anything besides a snail's pace.
And you would know, because that's the kind of Senate you presided over. And look, you give your members no leeway to vote their conscience. You want them all to vote in lockstep with you against anything the Democrats put up. Case in point, not one single Republican voted with the Democrats for the American Rescue Plan. And I'll tell you something, it's enjoying something like 70% approval across the country. But Mitch, Moscow Mitch, would not let any of his caucus vote in favor of it. That's not very comitous. That doesn't show comity in the Senate.
So, Mr. President, I want our colleagues to imagine a world where every single task,
yeah,
every one of them,
yeah,
requires a physical quorum.
Which is what you do now.
Which, by the way, the vice president does not count in determining a quorum.
Yeah.
Everything that Democrat senates did.
He just drones on. Basically, what he's threatening to do is shut everything down.
Compared to the disaster that Democrats would create for their own priorities.
Where Democrats would create the disaster. Yeah. No, Mitch, look in the mirror. Look in the mirror,
so
boy.
So this is not a trade-off between trampling etiquette, but then getting to quickly transform the country. That's a false choice.
Oh, really?
Even the most basic aspects of our colleagues' agenda, the most mundane task of the Biden presidency, would actually be harder.
Okay. You know what? I'm going to go to a different clip that's a little later on in this process where he lays out his threats right on the table.
This chaos would not open up an express lane to liberal change.
Oh, no?
It would not open up an express lane for the Biden presidency to speed into the history books.
What would it do,
Mitch? It would be more like a 100-car pileup. Nothing moving.
Wow.
And then there's the small matter that majorities are actually never permanent.
Well, there's that.
The last time a Democratic leader was trying to start a nuclear exchange, I remember offering a warning. I said my colleagues would regret it a lot sooner than they thought. And just a few years and a few Supreme Court vacancies later, many of our Democratic colleagues said publicly,
"You did this."
That they did.
He did this. Not the Democrats.
Touching
McConnell did this.
Touching the hot stove again would yield the same result. But even more dramatic.
Okay, where are the threats, Mitch? Come on.
As soon as Republicans wound up back in the saddle,
yeah,
we wouldn't just erase every liberal change that hurt the country.
Oh, no? What are your priorities,
Mitch? We'd strengthen
Mitch?
America with all kinds of conservative policies with zero input from the other side.
Well, what change is that?
This?
That's what
Nationwide
you always do.
Right to work for working Americans.
Okay, so no unions.
Defunding Planned Parenthood in sanctuary cities.
Great. Defunding Planned Parenthood in democratically run cities.
Domestic energy production.
Wow. Wow.
Sweeping new protections for conscience.
For
and
conscience?
The right to life.
So no women's health care. So women are forced
to carry reciprocity.
The fetus of a rapist. Nice.
Massive hardening of security on our southern border.
These are their priorities?
We saw during amendment votes just days ago that some common sense Republican positions actually enjoy more support right now than some of the Democratic committee chairs.
You get the idea. I'm not going to keep torturing you with his voice. Yeah, we're going to just shut everything down and we're going to do everything without the Democrats. And I'm going to threaten to just have no comedy in the Senate. Well, Mitch McConnell, I got the comedy for you. Not enough comedy? Let's have some comedy, Moscow Mitch style. We'll start with our friend Bruce W. Nelson, or is it Mangy Fetlocks? Take it away, Mr. Fetlocks, as, well, this goes back about a year, but the sentiment still holds. Moscow Mitch, indeed.
Howdy. This is yours, Mangy Fetlocks, the quasi-intellectual existentialist cowboy, coming to you from my man cave, or my fully equipped recording studio, or my wife calls it my garage. And I'm here to do a little song for you today about Moscow Mitch. Been hearing a lot about him and stuff, and I've been looking into what he's been up to, and he really deserves a song in his honor, because Mitch has been standing up to the American people like nobody else. Standing up for his beliefs and his own pocketbook. So anyway, I got a little song for him today. I got my keyboards here. By the time I put the tractor in the garage, I didn't have no space for a piano bench, so I'm going to be using that as my piano bench. But, it works okay, and it's portable. Natural selection, though damage.
Bruce W. Nelson.
I think we got her.
Or Mangy Fetlocks. Let's do one more. Whoops. Here's Lauren Mayer, everybody.
Moscow Mitch and Leningrad Lindsay. One's kind of slow and one's a bit mincy. Both started out helping rich folks get more rich. But lately there can be no refuting. They're in cahoots with Trump and Putin. What cats, Leningrad Lindsay and Moscow Mitch? Moscow Mitch and Leningrad Lindsay. The hashtags are getting under their skin. See, seems a little humor makes them twitch. They're both getting angry and bitter as their names are trending on Twitter. Poor sad Leningrad Lindsay and Moscow Mitch. Moscow Mitch and Leningrad Lindsay, full of it, hypocrite, witless twins each, leaving their reputations in the ditch. They're blocking attempts to protect our elections, but to Russian money they've no objections to taking scabs, Leningrad Lindsay and Moscow Mitch. Moscow Mitch and Leningrad Lindsay, they're being mocked from Queens to Quincy. Hey, to make this song rhyme, I fudged a smidge. And now we're seeing reasons aplenty to kick them both out in 2020. And their states can make a welcome switch. Too bad Leningrad Lindsay and Moscow Mitch. Das Vidanya.
These are the sounds of crushed souls, the sounds of despair from former radio personalities languishing in the purgatory of corporate consolidation. These former radio personalities have lost their livelihoods, not because they weren't entertaining or informative, but because they don't meet today's corporate terrestrial broadcast standards of being smelly, overweight douchebags, seething with vein-popping hatred. These radio refugees and their audiences have since migrated to the internet, but their struggle continues as the quest for monetization ensues. Nicole Sandler is leading the way to reestablishing thought-provoking and entertaining radio, and you can help by clicking the donate button on NicoleSandler.com. Donate today, or as much and as often as you can. Dry the tears of listeners by removing the rotting stench of corporate radio. Won't you help?
Ah, yes. Thank you for your support. All right. So I don't know what's going to happen with Mitch McConnell. He's just full of threats. And that's what he does. But, you know, I got to take a couple of minutes. I've purposely not talked about Andrew Cuomo much on the show. I did get into it with, I think it was with Amy Simon when she was here last Monday. But somebody, one of the, oh, shoot, hold on. You got no sound. I turned off the wrong speaker here, I believe. All right. Should have audio back now. One of the regulars, I was chatting with a listener the other day, and sorry, sounds coming back in just a second. YouTube, I hit the wrong button. So I was having a chat online with somebody who said, Andrew Cuomo has got to go. Sound is coming back. It's coming back. It's coming back. It's coming back. I see. Hold on. I got to tell YouTube. It's coming back. There you go. Okay. There you go. Back? Yes, it's back. Okay. Sorry about that. Again, I hit the wrong button. That was total operator error here. I apologize. All right. So, Andrew Cuomo. So a listener and I had a little chat. Actually, he was commissioning me to paint a portrait of his cat. And he texted me. He's like, you know, Andrew Cuomo's got to go. And, you know, I'm a little leery. I think Andrew Cuomo is horrible. As much as I adored his father, I can't stand the son. I think he never should have been elected governor. I have made my feelings about Andrew Cuomo known. That said, you know what? He's up for re-election next November. Let them do this investigation because we've been burned before. And by we, I'm talking about what happened with Al Franken. Al Franken never should have resigned. And while I'm not saying Andrew Cuomo deserves to stay in office, I'm saying we can't be railroaded by people whose motivations are suspect. I know it seems really bad as more and more allegations are coming out. It seems overwhelming, and it probably is. Do an investigation. Let there be no questions. Let it be by the book. Because here's what gets me. It's always the Democrats who, oh my God, somebody accuses them with Al Franken. I'll put it there. I don't believe Al Franken did anything wrong. I really don't. He's not a pervert, he's not a harasser. He was a comedian. That picture that started the whole thing was on a USO tour as he was a comedian, and he didn't touch her breasts. He took a stupid picture, and this was back in what, the 80s? Get over it. I'm sorry. My question about the Andrew Cuomo thing is all these women who said they had a problem with the way he spoke to them. You know, the one woman he said, oh, you're old enough for me. I'm lonely. Did she say anything to him? Because I never heard her say, I told him, this is making me really uncomfortable. Please stop. As far as I know, none of them said that to him. And if you don't tell him, especially someone who's an anachronism, right? He kept trying to blame his dad. My dad used to do this. Well, I'm sure not in the same lecherous way. And it's a different time. It's a different era. And if he didn't get the memo after all the Me Too stuff, well, then it shows him even more unfit for office. I'm not saying he's a good guy. I'm not saying he deserves to be governor of New York. I'm just saying let there be an investigation and let it all play out. Because we, the Democrats, tend to roll over too quickly and throw our own people under the bus. When, here's the question I have for you. I'm seeing journalists, I'm seeing public figures every day calling for Andrew Cuomo to step down. Where were those same people every day calling on Donald Trump to resign? Because if I recall correctly, the allegations against Donald Trump are a lot more serious than the allegations against Andrew Cuomo. I mean, this one woman said, yeah, he grabbed my hand and he held on to it and he kissed my hand. Yeah? Point being? And if he made you feel uncomfortable, what did you say to him? Because all I know is if I was with a man, powerful or not, who touched me inappropriately, put his hand on the small of my back, pulled me in a little too tight, said things that made me feel uncomfortable, I would say, excuse me, sir, that's inappropriate and you're making me feel really uncomfortable. That's one thing I haven't heard about from any of these women. Did any of them ever tell him, please stop, this makes me uncomfortable? That's the first question I'd ask as a prosecutor, as an attorney, as an investigator, right? Looking into this thing. Why did I all of a sudden get really blurry? It's just not okay. So, none of these women are children. They're not, what's the how does the saying go? It's shrinking violets? I mean, are you so weak that you can't speak up for yourself? Because from what I understand, he didn't sexually attack anybody. He didn't rape anyone in a department store dressing room, Bergdorf Goodman, I think it was, where Donald Trump allegedly raped a columnist. Can't these women speak up for themselves? Did any of them say to him, sir, please don't do that anymore. You're making me uncomfortable? Because sometimes you need to tell these people. They're so brain dead. They don't get it until you call them out for it. And that's why an investigation is needed. And you know what? If nobody told him that that behavior was offensive and made them uncomfortable, then you know what? Chances are he thinks it's all well and good. He thought he was having some good-natured, flirty fun. Well, you know what? It's 2021. Flirty fun in the workplace doesn't cut it anymore. But, you know, I also think about, are we a country of prudes? I mean, I remember with the Al Franken thing, there's this woman named Tina Dupuy. Tina Dupuy holds herself out there as this progressive commentator. She's been in and out of jobs where she's been the editor of like Crooks and Liars and different websites, and she tried a podcast. Now, I don't know what she does now, because frankly, at the tail end of the Al Franken insanity, she published an article and said, I too was harassed by Al Franken. And she told the story of posing for a photograph with him, and he put his hand around her waist, and she had a little roll of fat there. And his hand, grabbed onto it or something. And he made a comment. And you know what? He's a comedian. I know then he was a senator, but he is a comedian. If she felt uncomfortable, she should have said, excuse me, sir. That is highly inappropriate. Please don't do that anymore. But apparently she just smiled and didn't say anything until she wrote this article saying that Al Franken sexually harassed her because he had good-natured fun with her. People in Europe would look at us and laugh. They don't care about their politicians' sex lives. They don't care. It's the culture. And over here, it's like we're in a second Victorian age. So here's what I say. Loosen up, number one. If somebody does something to you that you find offensive, tell them. I mean, again, I want to question these women. And the one who sat for a four-hour Zoom interview with whoever the other day, I want to know, did you say anything to him? Did you tell him? Did you go to, I don't know if there was HR in the governor's office, but there's something, you know, the equivalent of, did you file a complaint? You see, this coming after the fact, when it's all too convenient, and I don't know what the ulterior motive is, and maybe it does have something to do with Donald Trump, who's being prosecuted by New York. I don't know that any governor, a Republican governor, would be able to make his troubles go away, but certainly a Republican governor would be friendlier to him than a Democrat or Andrew Cuomo would be. I just find it too convenient. Again, this doesn't say I hold Andrew Cuomo in any regard. It doesn't say I respect him or even like him. I'll tell you something. And if you were listening to this show back when this was all happening, when he was being lauded for his work on COVID, which we now that's an impeachable offense, lying about the deaths in the nursing homes from COVID. That's something that you can talk about him getting him out of office because of that. But I'm sorry, if any of these women, really had an issue, and I'm not saying that they don't, I want to know what they said to him at the time of the occurrence. Did any of them say, do not do that? That makes me uncomfortable. I think it's a reasonable request. In the meantime, there's two investigations going on. Let them at it. And hopefully they will hold him accountable for all the crappy shit he's done over the years. But, you know, don't. I really feel strongly about not letting the Republicans control the morality of the Democrats, because they certainly do nothing about their own. They're fine with a sexual predator in the White House. I never heard any of them call for Donald Trump's resignation or impeachment or removal or investigation. Nothing. So why are the Democrats so quick to roll over to let them dictate what we do with our people? I know it may be an unpopular position. I just feel like I had to say it, because all I keep hearing is the daggers out for Andrew Cuomo. I don't like the guy either. Again, loved his dad. Andrew Cuomo is no Mario. But, you know, let there be due process. If he really did do, you know, if there was sexual harassment, then hold him accountable. But it doesn't mean that we, you know, don't have due process. It doesn't mean that we should just say, oh, there have been allegations, he needs to go. We've seen this movie before, and it didn't end well. So anyway, that's my two cents. Now we're just going to switch gear. All right, because our guest is here. I see our guest is in the Zoom room, and I'm trying to fix the shot as I, you know, try to make an impassioned plea to defend somebody who I, you know, just really can't stand. And again, I'm not defending him. I'm just saying we on the left are too quick to throw our own party under the bus without due process. All right. At the beginning of the show, I mentioned that we were going to be speaking with a guest, the man who authored the book Climate Courage. In fact, let me bring him in here and say hello and welcome to Andreas Karelas. Am I pronouncing your name correctly?
That's right. Yes.
Hi. And thank you so much for joining us today. So you have a new book out. It's called Climate Courage: How Tackling Climate Change Can Build Community, Transform the Economy, and Bridge the Political Divide in America. All those things are very necessary. But I'm jumping out of order here. But I got to ask you, the first thing I have to ask you is, right now, I don't know of anything that can bridge the political divide in this country. I just heard Mitch McConnell make horrible threats against the Democrats. What he will do if, God forbid, the Democrats decide to, you know, change the filibuster process. And a lot of them still, I don't think they actually believe it, but a lot of them think or say that they think that climate change isn't real. It's a hoax. How will this bridge the political divide?
Yeah, well, I think that's a really good question, Nicole. And I think I want to point out the distinction between what the sort of leaders of, you know, political parties might say, like a Mitch McConnell might say, versus what Americans actually believe. And that's was one of the most interesting things for me as I researched the book, was discovering that actually more Americans agree on climate and clean energy than most issues. So particularly around clean energy, 85% of Americans would like to see their utility powering their electricity grid with 100% renewable energy. 85% of Americans. So when you think about how many issues do 85% of Americans agree on, not many come to mind, but clean energy is one of them. You also have 67%, so over two-thirds of Americans understand that climate change is real and is caused by humans. So there's actually a broad consensus. Like when we look at the news, when we watch TV, when we hear politicians talk about the issues, it makes it sound like they're so divided that the country is really, you know, at opposite ends of the spectrum when it comes to this problem. But the truth is, we're, as American citizens, we're actually much more on the same page around, yes, climate change is a problem. We see it happening and we know what the solutions are. And we're all about clean energy and the jobs it's going to create and the money it's going to save us.
Now, we are. I still hear, if you go into Appalachia, go to coal country, there are still people bitching that they've lost their coal mining jobs. I believe those are exactly the people who should be embracing the idea of a Green New Deal and jobs programs that the Green New Deal would create for infrastructure, which is one of the Biden administration's big priorities to move forward on, to get new green energy jobs. There are going to be tons of them. But yes. But if you listen to Fox or Newsmax or the noise from the right, they don't want to hear from it. I think a big part of the problem is the right-wing echo chamber, the media, who just, you know, they make shit up as they go along. And I mean, that's their slogan, Fox News, we make shit up. But the people who listen to that, they depend on those propaganda outlets for their news, have been brainwashed, and they believe the nonsense that's spewing in their direction.
Yeah, that's 100% right. I talk about in the book, actually looking at how much of an impact the media has on your views about climate change. And it actually goes to show that if you are a primary Fox News viewer versus somebody who watches a little bit of Fox and perhaps other news outlets as well, or somebody who doesn't watch Fox at all, that your belief and understanding of climate change parallels, is tracked basically according to how much Fox you watch. So there is very much, a skew around what we hear in the media, and there are a lot of reasons for that. But that's really the reason I wrote the book, Nicole, is that, for example, you brought up, West Virginia and Appalachia. One of the stories that I tell in the book is about a company, a solar installation company called Solar Holler, which is based in West Virginia. And it was started with this idea that we can work to train former coal miners to become solar installers. And they work with another organization called Coldfield Development to do that. And so those are the types of stories. There's actually a lot of positive sort of stories like that we could be telling, and that I would love to see that on the news, right?
Yes.
Look at all these former coal miners that are now trained and working in the solar industry. And so we as a climate, people who care about climate change need to do a better job at finding out about these good news stories and telling them and sharing them, on news outlets so that people can hear that we're actually making progress.
Absolutely. So, Andreas Corrales, let's back up for a moment here. We mentioned the book. You come to this from what you do for a living. You are the founder and executive director of Revolve. It's REVOLV, a nonprofit organization. It says that it empowers people around the country to help nonprofits in their communities go solar while raising awareness about the benefits of clean energy. This is a perfect example. I would love to have solar power. I live in Florida, the Sunshine State, which for years had tariff is the wrong word, but the disincentives to go for
yes.
solar. In fact, there were laws against it. You could not get solar power installed in Florida, in the Sunshine State. Now you kind of can, but it's certainly not easy, and they don't push it at all. There's no, program convincing homeowners, hey, let us put solar on your roof, right? And then, just for the other extreme, you can't turn on Bill Maher, not that I'd want to anymore, but you can't go a week without Bill Maher bitching that there in California, in Los Angeles, he still can't get his solar installed. What's the problem? What's wrong with us?
Yeah. So, one of the big issues is that in the country, we have every state has their own energy system and their own energy policies. And so oftentimes you have competing interests, particularly utilities and fossil fuel companies, that are lobbying at the state level and the other local levels in the city and county levels to make it harder for people to go solar. In fact, one of the stories I talk about in the book, again, talking about an example of unity on the left and the right, was a story where basically this woman, Debbie Dooley, who was one of the founders of the Tea Party, wanted to go solar in Georgia. And she, similarly to the troubles you're describing, the Georgia utility wasn't basically was going to charge her a lot of money and was going to make it disincentivize her from going solar. And so she actually reached out to the Sierra Club, right? And they formed what they called the Green Tea Party, the Green Tea Coalition. And it was, Tea Party Republicans who wanted to do energy independence, wanted the ability to, generate their own power on their roof.
Right.
And they felt that this monopoly utility was infringing on their rights. And they reached out to the Sierra Club, who was obviously, wanted to see more solar installed. And they worked together and they fought back against that, and they won. So there are examples like that. But that is the reality of the situation, is that so long as we have a lack of a national clean energy standard. As long as every state is making up their own rules, you're going to have a lot of factions that are trying to make it harder. Even in California, continually, it's a constant uphill battle because, let's face it, the utilities realize that and the fossil fuel companies realize that they're going to lose a lot of money when people start powering their energy with sunshine on their roof, which is for free.
Right. And many, in forward-thinking communities, I guess, the power companies work with people and they will purchase your excess solar energy. I mean, I still remember, I follow Tom Hartman on the Progressive Voices Network. And I remember many years ago, Tom was, he did a week's worth of remote broadcasts from Denmark. And he talked about, I believe it was there, the grid there, they had solar panels, on the tops of cars. Wow. And people would drive into work, right? They'd plug in, the excess solar would go into the system. The car would have to have enough power to go home at night, overnight charge. But it went in and went out, and it was like a living, breathing organism, and everybody would contribute to the energy buildup and then pull from it when they need it and feed it back when they're at rest. I'm oversimplifying it, obviously.
Yes.
But that's how it works in other places, and it does work. Germany is another example. They get most of their power, I think, from solar, don't they?
Absolutely. Yeah. And more so than the United States. And actually, they have a lot less sunshine there. Right. It's a lot cloudier there. And it still is able to produce, a tremendous amount of power. Yeah, I think, exactly what you just described is right. That's actually where we're going. So when you see, announcements from GM, for example, that they're going to be, making exclusively electric cars, et cetera. We are moving into an infrastructure where our cars are going to be electric. We're going to have solar on the roof. We're going to have battery storage. We're going to have microgrids so that our neighborhood is going to be more resilient against storms and fires and power outages that result. And that's already happening. Like, that shift is already happening. In Hawaii, for example, where the cost of electricity is very, very high, they are already seeing a tremendous amount of people going solar with batteries that are completely disconnected from the grid. We're going to move into not that that's going to work everywhere, but what we're going to see is exactly what you described, where people are both buying and selling. They're both producing and consuming power, and you're sharing it with your neighbors. So all of a sudden, you become your own business because you've got solar on your roof, and when you're at work, that excess solar energy is getting sold to the grid, is getting sold to your neighbors, and you're making money by doing that. That's going to be the world we're moving into, and there's certainly a lot to figure out technically, and there's a lot of innovation that needs to happen, but that is where we're going.
Andreas Karelas is with us. His book is Climate Courage, and one of the reasons that I wanted to talk to you is because you have a very positive outlook, and a lot of climate talkers are not so positive. It's more doom and gloom. It's like, oh shit, the planet's melting, it's heating up, the ice caps are gone, the glaciers are melting. And so you prefer to look at the solutions, how we can make things better. And in fact, people can go to climatecourage.us. And all this stuff is laid out in the book, but you have a section in the website, mirrors what's in the book, called Take Action. And you have different things for whoever you are. So you have, if you're a Republican, and action things. If you're a Democrat, if you're an independent, if you're the member of a religious community, if you're a parent, you're a teacher, you're a student K-12, you're a college student. So you lay it out, and there's more. I haven't gone through the whole list. Telling people specifically what they can do for their specific condition or position. So you're saying each and every one of us can do something. Because I know, for instance, I feel helpless. I used to have a Prius.
Yes.
Till my kid totaled it. And now I have a regular car again because it was more affordable. And this, you know, we're looking at the economics of it. What can I, as I guess being part of this in this pandemic has helped. In fact, there's a big news story that greeted me this morning about emissions are down because of the pandemic. Let me see if I can find it right here. IQ Air's 2020 World Air Quality Report said human-related emissions from industry and transport fell during lockdowns, and 65% of global cities analyzed experienced better air quality in 2020 compared to 2019. Well, that's because we were all at home. So other than staying home and not going out, which I guess did help, what can we do? What should we be doing?
Yeah, no, it's a great question, Nicole. And I think, you know, one of the things I talk about in the book, two really good points you brought up. One is that the climate movement has to do a better job at pointing towards the positive momentum that we have in solving the crisis. Because if all we talk about is how bad things are and how much worse they're going to get, people are going to tune out and they're going to ignore it and they're going to deny it, because nobody likes to sit with that feeling that, oh gosh, there's this big scary problem and it's going to, you know, ruin the world and there's nothing I can do about it. That will leave you, you know, sort of at a standstill. So we have to both acknowledge the reality that this is a crisis, this is an emergency, and it does require our immediate attention, but also look at how much momentum we have towards solutions. You know, I just read yesterday that in the United States last year, you know, solar energy was the most of all the new energy generation that was built, solar energy was the most. So we are, you know, seeing this trend continue to happen, not just in the United States, but around the world, where clean energy is getting cheaper and cheaper. Electric vehicles are getting cheaper and cheaper. People are creating, you know, we're creating jobs, we're saving money. You know, there's all these benefits, cleaner air, like you mentioned. There are all these benefits, so we have to really, you know, focus on the positive and say, how can we move forward towards that reality? How can we work towards something? And in terms of what can we do, I do lay out, you know, as you pointed out, some individual things that we can do. But really, Nicole, the main thing is that we've been told for a long time to focus on our personal footprints, right? Mm-hmm. You know, drive less, you know, use a reusable tote bag, you know, et cetera. And that's all important, and we should do those things, but that's not going to solve the problem alone. And then the other thing that we've been told is that the politicians are working hard to figure this out. Well, you know, don't hold your breath for that. So really, I think the area where we can have the most impact is in between those two, which is at the community level. And at the community, you can do things like help, you know, your neighborhood food bank go solar. You can work with your neighbors towards local solutions where you can see the real impact. You can work with your neighbor so you know that you're not alone. And then once those sort of solutions start becoming more visible, well, then the next neighborhood over, or the next town, or the next city or state, they're going to want to follow suit. Sure. And that's really where I see, you know, us being able to make a big impact.
And you do have a lot of actions that people can take depending on who they are, if you look at the book, or go to climatecourage.us. So a couple of quick questions for you. I have in the chat room, one of our regulars is a wonderful woman named Sandy Shellis. She does a program called the Environmental Coffee House. This is her area. And she asked, ask him if he is supportive of carbon capture. Now, I don't even know what carbon capture is. Do you?
Yes. Yeah. Carbon capture is the idea that we can take carbon out of the atmosphere and do something with it. The do something with it is a very varied sort of, there are a lot of things you could do with it. Mm-hmm. You know, what the what some people are suggesting is called sequestration, where you would bury it in the ground or bury it under the ocean. And there are a lot of problems with that. There are also ideas about how you can turn it into something else? You know, could you use it, for example, some instances of using it to make stronger cement, or even, there are labs that are working on, creating plastics and things like that. So I think that carbon capture is an important concept and will absolutely very likely be a part of the bigger solution of drawing down the carbon from the atmosphere. That being said, it really is a afterthought. The primary focus is we have to reduce emissions to zero right now. We need to stop emitting more before we worry about pulling down the carbon that's already been polluted. We have to stop, and that means going 100% renewable energy. That means reducing all emissions at all levels, rethinking how we do agriculture and forestry to absorb carbon into the atmosphere, into the soil, as opposed to releasing it, and things like that. So it is important. It's an important part of the mix, but it's definitely an afterthought after the primary focus of reducing emissions to zero.
Gotcha. Yeah. I've got another. We're running short on time. I appreciate you answering these questions because I've got one real burning question that I don't know if you have the answer or not. But here goes. Electric cars should have been here years ago. I lived in LA back when the EV1 was on the road. It was a wonderful thing, and everybody should watch the movie Who Killed the Electric Car, because it was a travesty. That said, now we have a directive or a promise that that GM is going to go all electric within the next however many years, a short period of time.
Yes.
I get it. If the power is solar generated, for instance, well, then it's a win-win. But if you're using an electric car and the power comes from a coal-fired power plant, are you still, coal's being burned. Are you still helping, or how does that work?
Yeah, that's a great question. And yes, depending on whatever the energy source is going to make a huge difference. But even if you're generating on regular grid electricity that has a lot of coal, it's actually still much less harmful to the environment than burning gasoline in your car. So that has been proven, because that's a big question. A lot of people ask that, but it is true. Even if you're using dirty electricity, it still ends up being cleaner as an electric car, with no tailpipe emissions. But that being said, we need to really work quickly to get off of coal, right? We need to work very quickly so that we can get to 100% clean energy, as quickly as we possibly can.
Cool. One last question for you. You mentioned in the book Climate Courage, and on the website climatecourage.us, climate courage circles in your community. What are they? How do they work?
Well, Sheryl Sandberg in her book Lean In, had this idea of lean in circles, and people could come together and talk about the book and talk about how they could help and support each other. And that was basically the idea. I just copied that concept, and basically on our website, you can create a climate courage circle. You can invite your neighbors, if you want to, read the book and take ideas from that, or otherwise just talk about climate change and talk about how you can get together with each other and start creating solutions. It's a place where you can do that, and the website's meant to be a resource to connect with other people.
Bill McKibben used to come on the show all the time back, in the early days of 350.org. I've been doing this for a while. He's off, doing his own thing. I noticed he wrote a nice blurb for your book. Back when 350.org was formed, the reason 350 was 350 parts per million of carbon in the atmosphere was supposed to be the drop dead, that was it, game over point. We've long passed that. Where are we in this fight? And are we past the point of no return?
No, we're definitely not past the point of no return. We are well above, I think, 410 parts per million at this point. I'd have to see, but we've gone beyond 350. 350 is the point where we want to get back to. It's not something that we're past it and we can never go back to it.
Right.
We can, as you mentioned, there's a great book called Drawdown, and it lays out, the top 100 ways that we can draw down carbon out of the atmosphere and get back. You know, once we reduce emissions to zero, we can start to implement the practices that will bring us back to 350 and stabilize the climate. The important thing to note is that actually, even recently, Michael Mann, who's a climate scientist, he just wrote a book, and he was on 60 Minutes, and his main message was that actually, once we reduce emissions to zero, we will actually be able to reverse climate change even faster than we previously thought.
Wow.
So it's very important that we get the message across that this is not a hopeless situation. This is not there's no game over. The faster we move, look, we will get to 100% clean energy. There's no, just from an economic standpoint, that's where things are going. The question is when, how quickly will we get there? The faster we get there, the less climate impact we'll have. That's the main message. And the sooner we'll start creating new jobs, saving more money on our bills, reducing our air pollution and the deaths that are caused by that. So it's all very much moving in the right direction. We just have to move a little bit faster.
Gotcha. Well, the book is called Climate Courage: How Tackling Climate Change Can Build Community, Transform the Economy, and Bridge the Political Divide in America. Andreas Karelis, it was a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for the work you're doing. It's very important, obviously. And I appreciate your time and input.
Nicole, it was an honor to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you so much. Well, I'm sure we'll talk again. I appreciate it.
Okay, great.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. Take care.
All right. And with that, we are done. That's it for yet another show. Thanks for listening, everyone. I'll tell you what, I will, because we can, I'll say tomorrow's Wednesday, Jeff Charlotte's going to be here. You know how much I love Jeff Charlotte, the author of The Family, C Street. He also writes for Esquire, and he has a piece in Esquire about the year of COVID that we've experienced. Tomorrow marks 1 year since COVID had spread to all 50 states. So there you go. So Jeff Charlotte will join us tomorrow. And if you disagreed with me about the Andrew Cuomo thing, I will leave time open at the beginning of the show tomorrow for your phone calls. Okay? Because I know I could just hear the screams coming through the interwebs. All right. I'll tell you what, because we didn't get to much news, I will leave you with today's What's News. Thanks for listening, everyone. See you tomorrow.
I read the news today.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Two men have been arrested and charged with assaulting U.S. Capitol Police Officer Brian Sicknick with bear spray during the January 6th riot at the Capitol. Sicknick later died. No homicide charges have been filed because authorities have not yet determined whether the toxic spray killed him. The men from Pennsylvania and West Virginia were recorded on videotape, one asking the other to, quote, give me that bear shit. That man is later seen discharging the spray into Sicknick's face. He also sprays two other officers. The suspects face 9 charges, including assaulting 3 officers with a deadly weapon, civil disorder, and obstructing a congressional proceeding. If convicted, they could face up to 20 years in prison. President Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris on Monday launched separate tours to promote the newly approved $1.9 trillion coronavirus relief package, the American Rescue Plan, the administration's first major legislative achievement. Harris visited a COVID-19 vaccination site and a culinary academy in Las Vegas, where she said that the tour was more, quote, education campaign than sales pitch, helping make people aware of the benefits. Biden stayed in Washington on Monday, but travels starting Tuesday.
When I signed the American Rescue Plan last week, I said help was on the way. This week, I can report it isn't just on the way, it's here, sooner than many ever thought possible. Over the next 10 days, we'll reach two giant goals. The first is 100 million shots in people's arms will have been completed within the next 10 days, and 100 million checks in people's pockets in the next 100 days. Shots in arms and money in pockets. That's important.
The administration is also launching a $1.5 billion ad blitz to persuade reluctant people to get vaccinated. While things here are going somewhat smoothly,
a growing number of European countries are temporarily halting the rollout of the AstraZeneca vaccine. This after reports of a handful of cases of blood clots in people who received the shot. The suspensions go against the advice of international medical agencies, which say there is no evidence that the vaccine is linked to the clotting and that rollouts should continue while the reports are investigated. This is a bad time for Europe as a third wave of infections threatens to grip the continent. Meanwhile, in the U.S., experts say a concerning variant is about to become dominant. And the American Red Cross reports that about 1 in 5 blood donations from unvaccinated people have COVID-19 antibodies, meaning that those donors had likely been infected with the coronavirus at some point. History was made on Monday as the Senate confirmed Representative Deb Haaland, a member of the Pueblo of Laguna tribe of New Mexico, to be Secretary of the Interior. Haaland is the first Native American cabinet secretary and the first Native American, period, to lead the department. In her Senate confirmation hearing, Haaland said, quote, "The historic nature of my confirmation is not lost on me, but I will say it's not about me." Later adding, "It's difficult to not feel obligated to protect this land, and I feel that every indigenous person in this country understands that." There is what some people are calling a crisis on the border. President Biden is facing growing political tension over his administration's strategy on the U.S.-Mexico border. More than 4,000 children have been stuck in Border Patrol-run facilities in jail-like conditions for extended periods because there's not enough shelter space to adequately care for them. There are a few factors behind the spike: devastation from 2 hurricanes last year, the toll of the pandemic, and the perception that since Trump is gone and Biden is in office, that enforcement is now more relaxed. According to a memo sent to the Dallas City Council on Monday, the Biden administration plans to house up to 3,000 immigrant teenagers at the K. Bailey Hutchinson Convention Center in Dallas to help mitigate the surge of migrant children at the border. A February surge of people crossing the southern border without legal status has overwhelmed facilities run by Health and Human Services to house migrant children. That's left many of them to be housed for extended periods in tent facilities run by the Border Patrol, which typically isn't supposed to hold children for more than 3 days. The convention center will be used for up to 90 days to house boys ages 15 to 17, starting as early as this week. So as jury selection was going on in the trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin for the murder of George Floyd, the city announced a $27 million civil settlement with George Floyd's family. Now, Derek Chauvin's attorney is requesting a delay in the murder trial because of the news of the settlement. He argued that the news, quote, has incredible potential to taint the jury pool. He also asked that the trial be moved. The judge, Peter Cahill, said he agreed that the settlement could potentially impact the case and said he will consider a delay, and reportedly said he would re-interview the 8 jurors who had already been seated when the news broke. Floyd, of course, died after Chauvin kneeled on his neck for nearly 9 minutes. Chauvin has pleaded not guilty to murder and manslaughter charges. So the Biden administration recently acknowledged that it had started reaching out to North Korea, but that Pyongyang was unresponsive. Well, now Kim Jong-un's sister is warning the U.S. against, quote, causing a stink at its first step. Okay. That reaction comes as the U.S. and South Korea conduct scaled down simulated military exercises. But even before that message, experts had said North Korea was likely to reject diplomatic efforts for the time being for a number of reasons, including the coronavirus pandemic, the Biden team's ongoing North Korea policy review, meetings in the region, and the administration's rhetoric. It's probably safe to say that no love letters will be exchanged between Joe Biden and Kim Jong-un. I got the news. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.